The body of Alan Hoare, who murdered his wife and three children before taking his own life, has been exhumed from the cemetery where he was buried alongside his family. Clodagh Hoare and her sons, 14-year-old Liam, 11-year-old Niall and 6-year-old Ryan, were found murdered in their home near Ballyjames Duff, County Cavan, last August. Alan Hoare's body was alongside them. Clodagh's sister, Jacqueline Connolly, has been speaking to our reporter, Kevin McGee, and Kevin is with me now. Good morning, Kevin.
Good morning, Karen.
This is the very first time we've heard from Clodagh's family.
Well, yes, I spoke to her sister, Jacqueline Connolly, just hours after she had watched the exhumation of the man who had killed her older sister and nephews, and she told me what kind of a person Clodagh was.
I used to call her Golden Girl, that, you know, she, in my eyes, she never put a foot wrong. She was just lovely. Clodagh was wonderful. She's a very kind sister, and she was always very, I suppose, level-headed. She would have been more level-headed than me. And, yeah, she, the kids, you know, growing up, they were always so respectful, and they were all very talented in different ways. Liam was quite athletic, and Niall was big into, you know, building Lego and baking. And Ryan just, when Ryan would be telling you a story, his eyes would be dancing in his head. He was just so full of life. I always think about the day that I got married, and I talked about Clodagh and what a wonderful sister she was and what a wonderful mother she was. And I said that if I was ever going to be happy, that I'd be as happy as she was.
And Jacqueline, Kevin, also spoke to you about the exhumation of Alan Hoare's body that took place yesterday morning.
Yes, I asked her if the decision to move the body was made by her and her mother, and here's what she told me.
We've waited 7.5 months for this to be done. We're relieved now. Clodagh and the boys shouldn't be there, but at least now they can rest in peace that he's gone. Thank God.
Did you request for him to be exhumed?
Yes, we did. We requested that the whole family put in an application to have him exhumed.
And how does that make you feel now that it has been done?
Well, I was there this morning when it happened, and as he left the cemetery, the sun broke through the clouds and I cried with relief that he was gone for good.
I mean, you obviously feel very, very strongly about this.
I do, absolutely, I do. At the time, I was able to read cruel, nasty comments online about myself and Mam, and how could we bury Clodagh and the boys beside their murderer. And what we'd like to say to those people is, be in our shoes. Be in our shoes when you get the news that a man you knew for 20 years has killed your whole family. He may as well have killed us as well, because it's no life to live. We weren't in our right minds. Funeral arrangements never came into our heads. We just couldn't even think about the fact that they were gone, never mind burying them.
Why did you decide at the time that the family should be buried together?
It wasn't a conscious decision. It just happened. It just happened. As days went on after the funeral, straight away we realised that it was the wrong thing that had happened.
Do you feel better now as a family, you and your mother, that the decision was taken and that he has been removed from the grave and that he's been exhumed?
Well, as I said, we're relieved that he's gone. But it doesn't change anything. Clodagh and the boys are still gone.
Was there ever any feeling that there were problems in the marriage?
No.
Jacqueline, how do you recover from something like this, to lose your sister and your three nephews?
You don't recover. We'll never recover. How will we ever have a life where Alan Hoare has murdered Clodagh, Liam, Niall and Ryan? What kind of a life is that to live?
The BBC has tracked down a serial child sex abuser who admitted his crimes to the police, but who was never brought to justice. He confessed in 1985 to abusing three different boys at three different care homes where he worked, but he wasn't charged and has never been brought to justice. He's now a retired church pastor and he lives in a remote part of Canada. Well, our investigations reporter Kevin McGee went there to confront him. Kevin joins me now in the studio. Kevin, you're very welcome.
Thanks, Declan.
So you've been to Canada to find this man, and we will come to that in a moment. But first, can you tell us just a little bit about him first?
Yes, he's a church pastor originally from North Belfast who now lives near the Canadian wilderness, and his name is Henry Clark, and he worked in three different care homes here during the late 60s and early 70s. Bonmore in Newton Abbey, Fairmount House in Antrim, and Conway Children's Home at Island McGee. Now, while working at each of these homes, he admitted abusing a child from each one of them. These were children in his care, and he made the confessions to the RUC after he was questioned in 1985.
Right, and I understand you've managed to find one of his victims and you've been speaking to that person.
Yes, his name is Billy Brown. He was one of the three boys who was abused, and he was a child resident at the former Bonmore care home in Newton Abbey. Now, he's waived his right to anonymity to speak to us. He remembers Henry Clark very well, and one day Henry Clark brought him to his own house, the boy was only 12 at the time, and he introduced the boy to his mother and father, and then he abused him. Here's Billy Brown.
I was that child, and I don't know how it came about. Why me? How was it in his head to pick me, to come and ask me to go to his house to help him pack or something? And the next spring you're in pyjamas, the next year in bed. But you thought that was it, because he was in his own mother and father's house. And for him to get into bed beside me and do what he done, why me?
Now, Kevin, the identity of this man, this abuser, was discovered after his confessions were included in evidence to the recent historical institutional abuse inquiry. Is that right?
Yes. At first, Henry Clark's identity was protected by the inquiry, but the BBC challenged this ruling and won, and we then decided to try and find him and discover more about why he was never brought to justice.
So was it difficult to find someone who'd emigrated to Canada, what, 40 years ago?
Well, we knew his name, Henry Clark, right? Once the order lifted the banning of his name. And we knew that he had become a church pastor after he emigrated. So I started to look for pastors of that name, and I narrowed them down until I found one that fitted the details of the man we were looking for.
Right, so after you began to feel sure that this was the Henry Clark you were interested in, you actually went to Canada to try and speak to him?
Yes, I flew to Canada and then to Edmonton. In fact, I travelled about 4,000 miles in all because I travelled about 6 hours north of Edmonton by road after we got there, and eventually I tracked him down to a small town hundreds of miles from the nearest city on the edge of the Canadian wilderness. Now, it's a really isolated and cold place. Temperatures dropped there to minus 50 in the winter time, and I called at his house and had a brief conversation with him, and I gave him a letter explaining why I wanted to speak to him, and the following morning he called me and I phoned him back.
Hello.
Hi, may I speak to Mr. Clark, please?
Speaking.
Hi, Mr. Clark. Kevin McGee, how you doing?
Good, thanks.
Did you get a chance to read the letter, Mr. Clark?
I did indeed. Got the shock of my life. My wife and I read it together.
Okay.
But my wife knew the background. No, okay. My kids don't.
Okay.
But my wife does.
Okay, okay. Well, obviously, I mean, I'd be very, very keen to have a conversation. Could we meet and have a chat?
Are you in town?
Yes, I am.
I
think we should do that.
Yeah, we would like to talk to you.
Okay, good. Well, let's do that.
My goodness, that's a remarkable phone call. So you did meet him, did you?
Yeah, and, you know, first of all, I spent about an hour and a half talking to him in his house, and he told me all about working in the three different care homes in Belfast and in one in England that he also worked in. And, you know, he said, yeah, I'm the same Henry Clark who told the police that I had abused three boys while I worked in Northern Ireland. And, you know, we had a long, long conversation.
And did he actually do a recorded interview then?
Yes, he did. And, you know, we went off, did the interview. And in that, he admitted the abuse in the same way that he had admitted it to the RUC back in 1985. And, you know, in the interview, I asked him if he was a... Did he appreciate and understand, you know, what he was doing and the fact that he was a self-confessed paedophile at that stage when he made those admissions?
I probably at that time would not have used the word paedophile, because I'd never thought of it. But subsequently, as years have gone on, I realised that, yeah, that's the proper word for what I'd done. There came a point where I knew what I was doing was wrong, and I went to the police, admitted it, expecting to be dealt with, and basically walked away from that. I took the opportunity to start a new life.
And Declan, that's what he did. You know, he started a new life. He's been living in Canada uninterrupted ever since. And you can see and hear more of that interview on BBC Newsline on our TV programme, which begins at 6:30. And, you know, he talks more about the abuse and what he was involved in. And, you know, I'll have more of this story for you in the morning, because there are some very, very important questions surrounding this. You know, the key question is, of course, how can a man admit abusing children to the police and escape justice?
How many children did you abuse in Bonmore?
One.
On how many occasions?
I remember one, and I remember it quite well.
And this happened in your parents' house. You brought a vulnerable child to your parents' home, introduced him to your parents, and then abused him in their house.
Yes. And for that, I've got no... I mean, other than I saw an opportunity and I took it.
And you subsequently saw other opportunities because you moved from Bonmore to a second children's home, Conway House.
Yes.
And you did the same thing there.
Yes.
You took advantage of a child and abused a child.
Yes.
Is this not a classic paedophile's profile, to move from one care home to another to another?
It's easy to look back and see the behaviour as paedophilia, but at that time, I didn't see that at all.
So you went then from Conway House to Fairmount House, and you abused a child at Fairmount as well.
It was one of those situations where an opportunity arose. And again, looking back, it was wrong, but I took the opportunity and, yeah, I interfered with a boy there.
But if you say that you knew your feelings were wrong, why did you put yourself in those situations where you were moved from one care home to another to another?
I don't really have a clear answer for you on that. There was the job situation, which I enjoyed. I enjoyed caring for young people and...
But you enjoyed it because you were getting access to children.
That's not fair. That's not the reason I did it at all. I did it because I enjoyed looking after them. I enjoyed the work. At a later date, I wrote a letter to the RUC. When I returned to Canada, I wrote a letter to them.
What did you write in that letter?
When I admitted to the detectives, when I was in Northern Ireland, I admitted to mention a boy that I had interfered with sexually, and I wanted to deal with everything, and so I wrote to them and asked them to take that into consideration. And we were expecting something to happen at that time.
What did you think might happen, or what were you expecting?
I realised at that time that my behaviour was wrong and that there were consequences. And I believe that in my mind I thought that I would probably finish up going to prison or something.
So you expected to be prosecuted and go to jail as a result of the letter that you wrote?
Yes. Certainly jail was a thought, but I wasn't sure what would happen. I was expecting some sort of consequences, yes.
Did you abuse any other children in Northern Ireland other than the three that you admitted to?
No. No, I didn't.
Is that an honest answer?
Yes. There was something in the back of my mind that what I was doing was wrong.
But why didn't you recognise it was wrong when you were abusing the children?
As a child, I had been abused myself, and I hadn't come to the point where I saw what I was doing as being wrong, because it seemed to be a continuation of something that I'd been taught. But that sounds as if it's an excuse. I'm not meaning it's an excuse, but it was one of those situations where the opportunity came along and I stepped into wrong behaviour.
Do you think about the impact that you had on these vulnerable children?
I wouldn't say every day, but from the time that it happened to now, I wonder what, how they are, what they're doing, what impact my behaviour, because I look back and I think of the impact that my abuse on me has caused me, and I often wonder about them. I even sometimes sit down and work out how old they would be and wonder what they're doing, wonder if they're married. And I would really ask for forgiveness and hope that I could make amends by having a relation, an adult relationship with them, and support them in any way that I could.
But children who you abused won't want to have a relationship with you. I mean, that sounds absurd.
Yeah, I see what you're saying.
But it sounds like you're using what you say happened to yourself as an excuse. You were taking advantage of vulnerable children.
I'd love to go back and redo or not do, but the actual fact is that my behaviour was wrong, and it involved people, and it involved people taking those feelings through their lives. And for that, I am really sorry, really sorry.
Does it feel just to you that you have lived a full life here in Canada while your victims' lives were blighted back in Northern Ireland by your actions?
Justice in the sense, what do you mean by justice? Like that I've had a good life and they've had a bad life? I hope they haven't had a bad life. I really do.
What impact did his abuse on you have on the rest of your life?
Hell. All my life I was abused in them care homes. I am 61-year-old coming next week. And I tell you what, I still live them all. I could tell you from the first to the last. From what he done in his mother and father's house and in Balmore till the rest of them, from the day it started me. There's people say to you, oh, you'll forget about it. You never forget about it. And anybody says a day need their head looked at. As I say, I'm coming 61. I still have the nightmares. But now I have a face.
Are you glad you've got that face now?
Oh, I'm glad I've got his face. Because he'll never hunt me again.
On the back of our coverage over the last few days, the PPS is now considering a formal review of the case involving all relevant matters relating to Henry Clark, and they've written to the Chief Constable, and they say that they're concerned that they didn't receive what they're calling significant evidence from the RUC in 1985, and they now want the police to provide that. And no doubt, Joel, they'll also want to review their own handling of this case and their own decision not to prosecute back in 1985 as well. And they say that they intend to contact one of Henry Clark's victims, Billy Brown, who we heard from over the last couple of days, to seek his views on this review. And Kevin, a few moments ago.
How long have you been in the UDA?
Years.
Well, it's an illegal organisation. Why don't you just walk away? Why don't you just tell them that you've had enough and that you want out?
It's not as simple as that. It's not the way it works. It's hard to explain to people the threat level they have against you and your family. If you walk away, they'll torture the life out of you. They'll damage your property. They'll attack members of your family. They'll attack you. It's impossible. You can't get out. No mission. The bosses, they need people to stay in the organisation to protect them.
So why, after all these years, do you suddenly want to leave? What's brought you to this point?
They're a criminal gang of no interest in Ulster or politics or anything else. They just want to make money, and I'm fed up with it. They're just gangsters that control an area from Whitewell right down as far as Larne, takes in Rathcoole, Monkstown, all of Carrick and Whitehead.
So when you say that they control these areas, what do you mean?
Control all the criminal activity goes on in the towns. Well, between the UDA and the UVF, but mainly the UDA. They control all the drugs that go on in the towns. Anybody that deals drugs must go through the UDA. They must buy them from the UDA. They give the UDA the money. If they're not a member of the UDA, then they're taxed so that they have to pay the UDA a certain percentage of the money they get from them. Any stealing that goes on, if there's any break-ins in businesses or whatever, they take a cut of that money. There was, for a while in Larne, prostitution going on. The UDA controlled all of that, any sort of criminality there involved in it.